Yay!
Welcome in to a very special Thursday edition of JR Morning as Lloyd Jackson celebrates a milestone birthday. Happy birthday, my friend.
Thank you, sir. Feeling good.
It's good to see you.
It's good to be seen.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
What are we doing? What's going on here?
I don't know what the plan is. My wife has some plan. I don't know what the plan is.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. So we'll have a plan. I'm sure she'll have a plan. But next weekend, it's going to be a big party.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So we'll really celebrate. So I'm turning 60 today.
60 years old.
Yeah. I don't feel like it. You know? I feel good.
You don't look like it either.
I feel really good, man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, happy birthday.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah,
appreciate
it. And we're going to talk about a lot today, obviously. And this one of the things that I was watching yesterday was, what was the House going to do in this Democratic effort to put some sort of check and balance on the president's ability to wage a war in places like Iran?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the president defeated yesterday. Lawmakers voted 215 to 208 to withdraw troops from using military force against Iran, absent congressional authorization. So there were five Republicans that flipped.
They flipped, yeah.
One of them was Tom Barrett of Michigan, mm-hmm. here. Thomas Massey, not a surprise there. But yes, very interesting that they decided to, and there was a vote that was scheduled yesterday,
yes.
on the floor that the Republicans pulled because they didn't have the support.
The support, yeah.
So it was pretty clear that something was bubbling under the surface. They were losing enough. And again, this is what you get in a thin majority.
You do.
Now, this would require, for this to be any sort of impactful move,
yeah.
legislative maneuver,
uh-huh.
it would have to pass the House, which it did. It would have to pass the Senate, which, okay. And then Donald Trump would have to sign it.
Of course he wouldn't.
So he would just veto this and they would move on.
And they wouldn't have the votes to override. So, I mean. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
So this will go nowhere more ceremonial than anything.
Than anything else.
Yeah.
An effort to overhaul how Michigan's public university boards are selected has failed in the State House, even after Governor Gretchen Whitmer voiced support for changing the system. The proposal needed a 2/3 majority to advance to the August ballot, but fell short in the Republican-led House, receiving 52 votes in favor, 54 opposed. Supporters of the plan argue that it would depoliticize governing boards at the University of Michigan, Michigan State, Wayne State, by shifting toward more gubernatorial appointments and restructuring how members are selected. House Speaker Matt Hall defended the measure ahead of the vote, saying the state needed to restore balance and address ongoing instability at universities. Opponents raised concerns about concentrating too much power in appointed positions and changing a system that currently allows voters to elect board members statewide. With the measure now defeated, lawmakers could revisit the issue for a possible November ballot, but, you know, the time is kind of running short before the deadline.
Yeah, certainly.
You got to kind of get on the ball if you're going to get it done.
Absolutely. How about this new report in the Detroit News? Michigan lawmakers accepted trips paid for by lobbyists, including travel to places like New Orleans and Turks and Caicos.
Huh.
These trips were paid to attend conferences and industry-sponsored events. It's part of a broader pattern where these groups are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars every single year to cater to lawmakers,
of course, yeah. mm-hmm.
for votes and access, yeah. things like that.
Yeah.
Everything from traveling to Turks and Caicos to a dinner in wow. Lansing, right? Everything in between. And there have been some lawmakers that have received thousands of dollars worth of travel perks as a result of this. High-end resort stays, things like that. Yes, it is legal here in the state of Michigan.
Yeah.
It is legal because I know you're thinking it.
You already know.
I know you're thinking it.
And you know the listeners are saying, well,
absolutely.
What?
You're driving around going, wait a second. Is that kosher? Yep, it is. But there are reporting requirements that have to be made. So there are loopholes and things like that. But
sure.
there are transparency problems here in the state of Michigan.
We already know that. Yeah.
We know that. But there are requirements where you do have to report this. And some have, some haven't. But, yes, it's legal. It doesn't look good, though.
It sure doesn't, man. It does not smell very well.
It does not look good.
Ford is recalling about 4,600 vehicles after a safety issue that federal regulators say could lead to a loss of vehicle control and increase the risk of a crash. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has issued a do not drive warning for affected models, citing a problem with front lower control arm ball joints that may have been installed or repaired incorrectly at the factory. Officials say the defect could cause the control arm to disconnect from the front wheel knuckle. The recall includes certain 2021 through 2026 Bronco Sport SUVs and 2022 through 2026 Maverick pickups. Ford says owners should not drive the vehicles until repairs are completed. Dealers will inspect and replace the faulty components free of charge. Notification letters are expected to go out by tomorrow, and owners can contact Ford customer service for more information. So be careful with that.
Be careful with that. Yeah, certainly. How about that? I don't know what happened. I don't know what kind of juju that Jason has from the sound that he's been playing.
Bro, it's the Lou Brown drops.
I don't know what it
That's
is.
That's called a winning streak.
Three in a row. They swept the Tampa Bay Rays.
I immediately thought of Jason. Yeah. And that drop when they won the third. I said, man, yeah. Jason is on the.
I literally dissected that cut into three different cuts based on the last 3 days.
Three different cuts. They won three straight games. Yes. All I'm saying is that's unbelievable.
I don't know.
They win yesterday 7-2. Troy Melton, Dylan Dingler getting it done for the Tigers.
If the Tigers find out about that, Jason, they're going to tell you to play that every day.
Right.
And I will be happy to do right. it. You know, Justin Verlander pitched five scoreless Tuesday night again. Like we said, we don't know how much that's going to help.
Right.
Yeah. But we're getting him back.
Yep.
Tarek Skubal's on the doorstep. Casey Mize on the doorstep. We did get Gleyber Torres back earlier this week. So, you know, we've seen this team go on a run before.
Yep.
Are we confident? No. But
no, not yet. But
there's a lot, you know, we're not even halfway through the season yet. So
we're not halfway through the season. That's exactly right. I mean, if they, you know, it's going to make it really difficult for them if they go on a bit of a run here and then all of a sudden, you know, do you trade Tarek Skubal? Do you not? Do you pull back on those plans?
Yeah.
I don't know. But if Justin Verlander is able to come back and give this team a spark every 5 days, that would be a really good thing.
That would be great.
It would be a really good thing. By the way, we're not the worst team in baseball anymore. We're not even the worst team in the division. Detroit 25-38, Kansas City 24-38.
Okay.
I'm just saying, things are looking up.
Looking up.
Listen.
Things are looking up in Tiger
Town. Sometimes it's the small things.
It's just the small things.
It's a nice series sweep to get you sparked.
Yep, yes. That's exactly right. Meanwhile, coming up on the other side, an executive order that focuses in on AI and the private sector, on innovation, on cybersecurity. We're going to talk about that and a whole lot more coming up next here on JR Morning. Well, we were talking a little bit yesterday as Anthropic takes
the IPO
to the IPO, and they're gonna go public.
Yes,
and this has been that arms race amongst these companies and who can get there first. What's the valuation going to be? I mean, you're talking huge money.
Yeah,
these are record breakers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it begs the question of, look, you could be a bit of a pessimist like me. But even a pessimist like me understands and realizes what artificial intelligence is, what it's going to do, mm-hmm. all the good it's going to do. Of course, there's going to be some downsides.
Of course,
there always is.
Because people like, you know, will use things for the
wrong
reason.
I mean,
of course.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of good that's going to happen. But there are still a lot of questions on jobs and what happens in terms of government overreach or oversight.
Yeah.
Yeah. All of those things exist. Marva Hickok, is the president and policy director for the Center for AI and Digital Policy. She is in Paris at a conference titled Human Flourishing of the Age of Tech of AI, and joins us this morning to talk about it. Marva, good morning. It's good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about where you think this technology stands now, because it feels like we're right on the cusp of things really changing on the AI front.
I think looking at the public sentiment surveys over the years, we see a significant increase on how people are concerned about AI's impact on their personal lives and their ability to access resources and opportunities. But also concern about power concentration, whether that is money or access to information as well. So the way that we're seeing it, we need to collectively work on ensuring that power access to the benefits are equally distributed or more beneficial rather than just a handful of people or organizations benefiting from it.
Barbara, how does the conversation happening over there in Paris compare to what we're seeing unfold here in the United States with this executive order of the president?
Well, within the executive order, let me mention what it includes and how it compares to Europe. It is a voluntary framework, and it is focused mainly on cybersecurity vulnerabilities that impact national security. It does not have anything about, you know, civil rights, freedoms, or safety, like child safety or public safety or anything in between. So it's purely cybersecurity. And it is a confidential or classified framework. Whereas in Europe, there are mandatory or mandated requirements on how the systems might impact individuals or even organizations. Companies or deployers have to be transparent about it, so there's nothing classified about things. And it companies and deployers have to assess pretty much any risk that they can foresee that impacts fundamental rights, safety, health of individuals as well. So I think it's a more comprehensive approach in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there needs to be strict oversight of this type of technology?
Not strict oversight, but definitely oversight, a baseline oversight for especially in domains where it ends up what we call high impact or high risk domains, where it might impact your access to doctor, like healthcare or education or employment, or how you get the government services or how law enforcement, etc., might be using it. So we definitely need more transparency and oversight of this rather than companies making these decisions on behalf of society.
You know, the president's order directs federal prosecutors to aggressively pursue AI-enabled cybercrime. Is stronger enforcement enough, or do we need entirely new laws designed specifically for, you know, AI in this AI era that we're in?
I think it's we need better laws. I'm not necessarily saying stricter, but no laws that might be modernized that address the current challenges and the evolving landscape. For example, we're talking about now agentic AI, the type of capabilities that you can ask to take actions on you. So it can go and buy things for you, change your bank accounts, etc. So imagine that being hacked or an agent making a decision that you didn't intend. We need to have laws in place to be able to trace those back and take action.
Mm. Marva Hickok, thank you so much for your time this morning. Really interesting stuff. Enjoy Paris, and we'll talk again very soon.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you got it.
Wow.
It's fascinating. And how different parts of the world are looking at this technology.
Yeah, and it's just going to continue. We're going to be hearing more and more and more about this, you know, not just from the United States and what we're doing, but from what other countries are doing as well, because it's everywhere.
I saw this story on Axios about Donald Trump's face being on a $250 bill.
Some people just will be happy to have a $250 bill.
You know, how about that?
Who cares who's on it, but okay.
It would have to, you'd have to get one.
Yeah.
And then keep it.
Right.
A $250 bill, that's...
When you frame it. And
that's not
it
usually in the arsenal.
No, not
so,
usually.
You'd have to, you know, have one, keep it for safekeeping.
Yeah.
Frame it, like, you know, you see on a restaurant where they make their
first dollar.
Yeah.
Right.
But I saw this story on Axios about how, a quarter of Donald Trump's base is not sold on the idea that he should be on a special bill. First of all, only dead people can be on bills. It's law in the United States.
Oh, okay. That's the only people I see on bills.
It is spelled out in federal code.
Yeah.
Quote, only the portrait of a deceased individual may appear on United States currency. meaning Donald Trump, as not a deceased person,
could not be on
there. Is not eligible to be on a any sort of bill.
Yeah.
There is a way that he could be on a coin. There would have to be special approval, things like that. I don't think he wants that. I don't think he wants to be on a coin.
No.
He just, you know, they just got rid of the penny.
Exactly.
So I don't think I think we're moving away from change.
No.
I think we're moving away from change.
He doesn't want anybody to flip him.
But this goes back a long time. I don't understand. Like, this story doesn't even talk about that.
Wow.
We're just ramping people up.
I mean,
like, Donald Trump's going to be on the $250 bill. None of this is, like, real yet. This is not going to happen.
What do we always say about money? We call them dead presidents, right?
Right. Right.
I mean,
I don't know why this has become, like, this hot button issue. Nobody wants it. Nobody wants this. Even Republicans on Capitol Hill, they're not going to change the law so Donald Trump can be on a special bill.
Yeah.
It ain't going to happen. Coming up on the other side, China catching up with us on autonomous driving. It's next on JR Morning. Interesting piece in the Detroit News from Brianna Noble talking about market conditions in China and changes there, especially to their regulatory reform that is speeding up development of autonomous driving technology there.
Mm-hmm.
And it poses a big threat to driving technologies here in the United States, according to Brianna Noble and folks that she talked to here in this piece. One of the people she talked to was Chris Liu, who is a senior automotive analyst in Shanghai at a technology research group. He says China is catching up fast. Just like a decade ago, they were not so great in battery technology, but now we're not just putting a lot of effort into investment into R&D, but they're also tied to scale. So what we're seeing out of China, and this is part of the issue that we're hearing about, like the legislation that Haley Stevens and Alyssa Slotkin released.
To keep the Chinese cars from coming across the border.
Yeah, yeah. And that's even just like day trips. Like they don't even want those cars coming in over the border at all.
At all, period.
Because it is a national security concern. We don't know exactly what's in these vehicles.
They could be spying.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So there's all of these issues with these Chinese vehicles. Top of that list, I mean, obviously, the national security threat that is there, whether that's legitimate or not, it's
a possibility,
there.
Yeah.
But these vehicles are so cheap. And what you would do, essentially, is you would undercut American manufacturers here. The automotive industry here in the city of Detroit would be crushed.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so it really is an absolutely huge problem. But the fact that these companies in China are scaling up this technology, this is where, you know, I go back in the last 5 to 10 years. 5 years ago, we were talking about autonomous driving technology almost exclusively.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And what that would look like.
Mm-hmm.
Because at some point, if autonomous driving is going to be as pervasive as some analysts had expected, would you even need to buy a car?
Well,
because essentially it's all going to be an Uber service. You call one and they come to your house, they pick you up, take you to work.
Yeah. Well, look at young people nowadays. I remember when I was 16, man, I wanted to get my driver's license and I wanted a car and I wanted to drive.
Right. You wanted out.
But these kids now, it's not necessarily like that. You know, they're getting Ubers and they're doing, you know, because they want to be in the back seat on their laptop or on their phone or TikTok or something. They want to be doing something else other than driving.
It is a little different here, maybe as opposed to places like Chicago or New York or L.A. where there's like a transit system in place.
True.
Right? It's different.
Yeah.
Because you don't necessarily rely on your own vehicle in those places.
And bad traffic.
And bad traffic. Absolutely. Spends 17 hours on the 405.
Exactly.
You don't need that. Ain't nobody need that.
No.
So I think that it depends on where you're at. But this idea of autonomous driving here in the United States, but that got replaced a bit by electric vehicles. And not that companies were taking their eye off the ball on autonomous driving, but the focus certainly did shift towards manufacturing electric vehicles, improving the grid, improving reliability, taking away some of the fears that people had about an electric vehicle. And they did a lot of that. But they have been working on different autonomous driving technology and certainly, you know, Tesla was leading the way on that for a long time, still is, for a huge extent. But Waymo now is going to make its way into the city of Detroit, so you're going to see those putzing around town.
Talking about that just recently, about Waymo and what they're going to be doing here in the city. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's fascinating to me that we're seeing that places like China are really ramping up their efforts on this front.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, us being in front with the autonomous driving, did we not think that China was going to really, you know, delve in and try to, you know, get to where we are as well, mm-hmm. and maybe try to, you know, pass us? I mean, you have to suspect that anyway with anything we do with automotive, that they're going to try to surpass us.
But this is where it's imperative that we as a country, as the federal government, does not allow this to happen.
Right.
And I don't mean, you know, mandating American companies, you know, focus on this technology. I mean keeping them out.
Yeah.
Period. End of story.
Yeah.
So it has to be a major priority. Meanwhile, Barry Weiss, the editor-in-chief at CBS spoke a little bit yesterday about the Scott Pelley firing.
Yeah.
She said, "I'm only interested in working in a newsroom that is built on trust and mutual respect. We cannot do our work without it. That foundation was broken on Monday."
So basically, they're saying, you know, that Scott Pelley fired himself. Is what they're trying to say on the slide. He fired himself because of what he did. He fired himself, you know.
Well, this stance that he took as Nick Bilton, the new executive producer of 60 Minutes, came in, and he was not pleased with that.
Yeah.
And they did let go a couple of other
60
Minutes reporters. But I mean, Scott Pelley is the top.
Does Scott think that maybe by doing it in front of everybody that he would get some other people? Because it seems like to me that, you know, when you do this, you don't care if you're going to get fired, because, you know, you're getting in front of the boss and all of these people and trying to make a fool out of the boss. Did he think that other people would quit, you know, and leave 60 Minutes?
I don't know. But here's the thing, is things change. Nothing stays the same forever. And 60 Minutes has largely remained relatively the same. They've had, you know, their reporters, especially at the top, have been there for a very long time. I mean, you know, you just had, what's his name, over at CBS. I can't think of his name. He just left.
Stephen Colbert.
Not Colbert. The other dude at CNN.
Oh, Anderson Cooper.
Anderson Cooper. Anderson Cooper just left.
Yeah.
He says he wants to step back. I mean, this dude's got a million jobs. So he's like, I want to spend time with my kid.
I get that.
Right? Okay, that's no problem. He didn't cite any sort of turbulence at CBS as a reason for him leaving.
Yes.
But the fact that that there is change shouldn't be necessarily scary in my mind.
So, but what things have turned out different if Scott Pelley just had this conversation one-on-one in the office with the door closed?
I think you'd be in a totally different situation.
Okay, yeah.
I think you'd be in a totally different situation. Yeah. Again, Matt Friedman, our PR consultant friend, put out an interesting piece about, you know, you can do what you want when you get to a certain level, right? Once you get FU money, you can take some chances. You can roll the dice. You're the guy.
Yeah.
Right? He's the guy at 60 Minutes.
Yeah.
And so he rolled the dice. Unfortunately, he didn't roll a 7.
Snake eyes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So the outrage over the Scott Pelley firing is not something that I understand. This dude did something that he knew there could be ramifications.
If he had
this conversation with Nick Bilton behind closed doors, one-on-one, I think it would be a totally different situation.
I agree.
But when you get out in front of an entire crew of people that are working on a show
and try to make a fool out of your boss,
well, generally that doesn't go well.
Usually doesn't.
Generally doesn't
end well. Doesn't end well.
No. So what happens next? I don't know. For 60 Minutes, we'll see. But there is a change, there is a shift, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No.
But people like consistency.
They do.
People like to know. Well, Scott Pelley's working on a story. I think that's good. There's been a lot of questionable things that 60 Minutes has done, in my opinion, in their reporting.
Yeah.
I think they've done things that weren't necessarily fact-based reporting. But, of course, everybody's going to trip up that time to time.
Absolutely.
And so I don't blame – there's no – I don't harbor any ill will towards 60 Minutes Scott Pelley.
They still keep the stopwatch. It didn't go digital. the stopwatch at the –
Exactly right.
It's been the stopwatch since I was
a kid. Tick, tick, tick. Yeah. Michigan drivers are facing a major soaring costs when it comes to new vehicles or insurance. Even used vehicles are going up. We'll talk about that on the other side here on JR Morning. But first, no matter where you look, rising costs are hitting you hard. And when you're forced to make tough choices, keeping the lights on or the air conditioning on should never be one of them. Consumers Energy is stepping up, giving back $5 million to assistance agencies and supporting efforts to increase energy assistance dollars for families in need by 50%. And with personalized energy savings programs, you can actually take the steps to start reducing your energy bills today. So I don't know what you're waiting for. Count on Consumers Energy for that support. Learn more at consumersenergy.com/help. And, of course, all of the talk about autonomous driving and electric vehicles and things like that bleeds over into, all right, well, there are people that still need vehicles.
Yeah.
And look, new vehicle sales are going to be all over the map at this point, right? I mean, that's just the reality because more people are hanging on to their cars for longer.
Longer times, man. Absolutely. Because even the used cars are up there as well.
Used cars are more expensive right now. Yeah. And then you've got the situation insurance premiums are still too high.
Yes, they are.
Here in the state of Michigan. And there's been a lot of work done and legislation done to try to bring those down. But the reality is we're still lagging behind other states in terms of that cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it becomes a problem when, you want as a 16-year-old to be able to go get your license and get a car eventually. But you have to look at it in a cumulative way because – at some point, once you graduate college, right, you probably, you very likely will have your own car in high school.
Sure.
Right?
Yep.
Whether that's a beater or, I remember my first car, I was maybe 17.
Okay.
And my mom was getting a new car, so I got her old car.
Okay. That's usually how it works.
It was a 94 Chrysler New Yorker. I did love that car.
Wow.
I love that car. And I loved about it is you could fold the armrests up front, and then there was another seat there. So you could fit six people in that car.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Well, I didn't realize that you needed to maintain a vehicle.
Oh, you just put gas in it? That's all you did?
That's about it. It was about the extent of how I took care of my vehicle.
Okay.
So my wife's birthday is always around the Detroit fireworks.
Uh-huh.
So she was like, let's go downtown and go to the fireworks. Okay, let's go. So we pack six people in that car. We're driving down 696, and all of a sudden, smoke starts billowing. I probably had this car for 4 months.
Dude.
Right? Smoke starts billowing out of this thing. Yeah, it was probably a little longer than that, maybe like 9 months or so. It starts billowing out of the hood. I pull over. All of a sudden, can't drive the thing. I'm like, I don't know what's going on here.
You done busted a rod.
Oil is good for vehicles.
Usually it is.
Yeah, I learned an important lesson that day because that was the last time I drove that car. Engine was fried.
Gone.
So people are making sure that they're taking care of their vehicles longer because the average cost of a car payment now on a new or leased vehicle is like $1,000.
Dude, and I go back and remember when, car payments were, $200, $250, and then it got to $300 and $400 and then maybe $500 and you say, oh, God, man, but $1,000?
Yeah, it's a lot of money. Adam Taub is the consumer law attorney at the Adam G. Law Taub & Associates and joins us this morning. Adam, it's good to have you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
What can people do in this time when just the cost of these vehicles are so much, cost of used vehicles are so much? What can people do at this point?
Well, I think when you're going to go car shopping, you have to remember one very essential thing, most people at least do, and that is that you're buying two different things. One is a car and one is a loan. And because of that, you really need to shop around and get competitive prices for both the car and the loan. One of the ways that people end up paying more for cars is that they don't pay attention to, I guess, the you know, where the which card is the one you're supposed to pick. There's a lot of moving parts, is what I'm trying to say. And so, you know, you want to nail down a price, and make sure that you go and shop that price around for a similar car. And remember, there's nothing, you know, you're not going to get anything that's too good to be true. But make the dealership stick to a price for the car itself. And then, and this is the hard part for a lot of people, you have to make sure that you shop the price of the loan. And people will say, what do you mean price of the loan? Well, you got to look at the annual percentage rate, the APR, or the interest rate. And you need to make sure when you go in that you know what your credit score is. Don't let the dealership tell you what your credit score is. Make sure you're familiar with your credit score, and go to different sources and find out what you qualify for. Don't let the dealership tell you what you qualify in terms of the APR.
Right.
Because a lot of people don't understand this, but the dealership is not working with you to get you a good rate from the bank or the credit union or car financing institution. They're profiting, the dealership,
yes,
from you paying a higher rate. So you need to do all of that legwork, and you need to do it independently to make sure, again, there's two things you're shopping for, and I stress this to everybody, including other lawyers, the price of the car and the price of the loan.
Well, and probably the same way for insurance, right? You got to shop around to make sure you're getting the best plan at the lowest price.
That's correct.
Right.
You've got to know what you're getting, and you have to be on top of it. And,
right,
you know, unfortunately, don't necessarily trust the people who are benefiting from you paying a higher price. There's,
right,
some other things that you can do to avoid paying higher prices.
Well, and
like
that's
cars.
And that's just the legwork that needs to be,
sure,
done
absolutely,
when you're doing
due
your due diligence.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Adam Taub, thanks so much for your time and insight on this. Really interesting. We'll talk again very soon.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
You got it. Interesting. 7 o'clock hour coming up. Get you caught up on the headlines. More next on JR Morning. Good to have you here on a Thursday. It's Lloyd Jackson's birthday. It's a very special day.
It's your birthday. It's your birthday. We going to party like it's your birthday.
How about that?
Oh, wow. Yeah, it is, man. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good day today. Good day today.
The big 6-0.
6-0.
How about that?
6-0. Yes, sir.
How about that?
But I don't feel like 6-0.
No.
You know?
No. And, did they have color TV when you were a kid? No, just kidding.
It came out.
Yeah,
color,
yeah,
was like in 50 something. Yeah.
I'm messing with you. Happy birthday.
Thank you, brother.
It's awesome.
Appreciate it, man.
How about this? Donald Trump got a rare blowback in the House yesterday as a number of House Republicans joined Democrats to curb the president's war powers in Iran. It was a 215 to 208 vote to withdraw troops from using military force against Iran without congressional approval, without that authorization.
Uh-huh.
All the Democrats voted for the measure, as did Thomas Massey and Michigan's Tom Barrett, who is a veteran.
Yeah.
Flew helicopters, Black Hawk helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
And it was becoming clearer that even, I think there was one Democrat in the House that was siding with Republicans on this for much of this time. But you could tell there was a change in at least some of the representatives,
sure,
on the Republican side and how they were looking at this. You had the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Brian Mass, telling Fox News, "It's just a total BS vote. I think there's no Democrat, no Republican that can tell you what forces they would want to pull from Iran." And again, this isn't going anywhere.
I was
going to
say,
because it's got to get past the Senate.
Yes.
And then it's got to get to the president's desk. He would have to sign it.
And he's going to veto
it. It's not going
to
work.
And they don't have the votes to override.
Correct.
So it's just kind of symbolic, right?
For the most part,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things that Marco Rubio told lawmakers over the last couple of days as he testified to Congress was the war is over. Operation Epic Fury is done.
Yeah.
And so that seems to be the way that they are
kind of getting around the
just kind of moving the chess pieces around the table.
Yeah.
Now, it seems like that is legitimate.
Even though some bombs do fly every now and then.
Right. But also that happens all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, that happens not all the time, but frequently enough to where it wouldn't draw some sort of action from Congress to require the president to go through them and to take a War Powers Act vote.
Right.
So it's ceremonial on its face and they move on. But it sends a message. To a certain for the president to a certain extent.
It does. Two Michigan State University trustees are refusing to sign a newly revised code of ethics, saying it goes too far and violates free speech rights. Trustees Rima Vassar, Mike Balal held a press conference on the Capitol steps, urging the Policy Forces board members to support majority decisions rather than publicly disagree with them. They say that requirement could lead to sanctions, including censure or removal. If it doesn't align with my values and principles, I just won't do it. That's according to Vassar. And Balal called the rule a form of silencing dissent. The dispute has drawn national attention from the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, which warned the code may violate the First Amendment. MSU officials dispute those claims, saying the policy underwent legal review and pointing to similar rules at other universities. The controversy comes amid leadership turmoil at MSU, including the resignation of its president, and is expected to be revisited at the next board meeting, which takes place June 12th in East Lansing.
Interesting. And the governor has signaled that maybe she would be in favor of changing the way how board members are selected here in the state of Michigan.
And an effort to overhaul how university boards are selected, it failed in the state house even after the governor voiced her support for changing the system. The proposal needed a 2/3 majority to advance to the August ballot, but it fell short in the Republican-led House, receiving 52 votes in favor, 54 opposed. Supporters of the plan argued it would depoliticize governing boards at the University of Michigan, Michigan State, and Wayne State by shifting toward more gubernatorial appointments and restructuring how members are selected. House Speaker Matt Hall defended the measure ahead of the vote, saying the state needed to restore balance and address ongoing instability at universities.
Interesting.
So we'll see.
Yeah, and that was obviously a big talk of
Mackinac yes.
after Kevin Guskowitz stepped aside at Michigan State University, citing some of the issues with the board.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the Tigers win yesterday 7-2. They
Yay!
Beat the Rays. They scored 25 runs in that series. Absolutely unbelievable.
The bats just came alive.
They came alive. And we blame Jason for all of the good fortunes we've
keep,
had.
Keep that money saved for those playoff tickets. Let's go. Turning it around.
Okay. Just keep those drops coming.
Keep stuffing it under the mattress. Keep it coming.
That's called a winning streak.
It is a winning streak. That's three in a row. They haven't won. Have they won three in a row? Oh, yes. They haven't won three in a row since. Oof. Hold on. Let me keep scrolling. Boy. Let me keep scrolling. Back on April 16th was the last time they had won. They swept Miami and Kansas City in back-to-back series April 10th through the 16th and haven't had a three-game winning streak since then.
So this was their first sweep against a real team.
Correct.
Yes.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. And Tampa Bay leads their division. So,
and
yes.
The NBA Finals last night, the Knicks beat San Antonio in San Antonio. I was like, what? What's going on here?
Lloyd, during the break yesterday, was like, man, I think San Antonio's going to sweep the Knicks out of the building.
I did.
Yeah, I didn't argue with you.
But listen, those Knicks, man.
They're scrappy.
Something going on with
Something's going on.
Yes.
Something's
they never know when they're going to get back there, so they better make the most of it.
Exactly right.
That's
exactly right. 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by shelving.com. We rock your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. Consumers are relying on AI for what seems like, well, everything these days, and for good reason, because that is the new reality. We are relying on it for just about everything, even when it comes to managing our personal health care. That, according to a just-issued 2026 patient choice report from healthcare reputation management firm Rater 8, And as reported by Media Post, reliance on AI to choose a healthcare provider has more than doubled in the past year, from 17% a year ago to 36% this year, completely upending traditional methods like search engine marketing and referrals from other doctors. The report found that 47% of respondents have used AI tools like ChatGPT, Claude, Perplexity, or Google's AI overviews to research providers, up from 31% in Rater 8's prior research done 9 months earlier. And one surprising finding, more 45 to 60-year-olds, 64%, than any other age group reported actively using AI to find their providers. Only 28% of 18 to 29-year-olds did so, for example. A possible explanation, according to Media Post, thanks to most Google searches now automatically triggering AI overviews, the report states, patients aren't necessarily choosing to use AI, rather it's being placed in front of them. Not only are Google AI overviews growing in use, but patients are trusting them more, which directly affects the search engine marketing. And when asked which section of Google search results they most trust, AI overviews have now overtaken traditional organic links among survey respondents. Now, the Patient Choice Report is based on a survey of over 1,000 U.S. patients over age 18 conducted in April via SurveyMonkey. So there you have it. AI continuing to permeate everything, now even deeply embedded in the process of finding healthcare providers. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the Great Voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
All right, so a little bit of change in plans. Dr. Steve unable to come in today, so we put Therapy Thursday on ice for this week.
So whatever therapy we need, we got to...
Yeah, just shove it down deep. And don't address any of those issues.
Exactly.
Don't look in the mirror at all. Just push it all
just
way
push
down.
It away. Just and hold it down in the basement until we can see Dr. Steve again.
Yeah, and then we might have to do an entire hour with him the next time we see him. I do need your help a little bit, though.
Okay.
Because I need to know if I broke the law.
Okay.
I kind of feel like I did.
All right. Now, you know I'm not a lawyer, but I play one on the radio sometimes.
Yeah. My worry is that you're going to go, Chris, this isn't self-incrimination, and you shouldn't be talking about this on the radio.
Plead the fifth.
It's going to be used as permissible evidence in a court of law. So our house is for sale.
Yes.
It's on the market, right?
Uh-huh.
And we have on our front porch area, we have four hooks to hang flower, like hanging
flower pots. Yeah. Okay.
So we got a few of those and we put them up there. So we have four of them. Oh, for whatever reason, one of the flowers died. And I was like, all right, I got to take it down. I'll go get a new one.
Sure.
And so I unhook it and I take it down and I look in the pot and there is a bird's nest in there with three eggs.
Mm.
Now, if you remember, if you've listened to this show, last year I had a problem with birds.
Yes, you did.
In the same area.
Yes, you did.
They were building them under right next to my front door. We have two lights next to my front door, and they were building them, building nests on these lights.
Okay.
These sconces that are on the wall.
They like your house.
They love my house. I love that they love my house.
Okay.
My problem is one of the reasons I, again, the flowers were dead, but these birds were out there all the time. Chirp, 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 chirp. It was crazy. I'm like, there's got to be something in that tree right in front. There's a nest or whatever.
Yeah.
So I take it down. I see it. Now I know that there's a nest in here.
Okay.
And I'm like, okay, well, I got to replace this plant that is dead.
Yeah. Can't have three up there that are looking good and one that's dead.
Correct.
Yeah.
So but then I saw the nest with the eggs in it.
Okay.
And I'm like, oh no. Now I can't. I can't take the nest out. Cause if you certainly can't like touch the nest. Cause then they smell it, they know something's wrong, and then they don't come back.
They won't come back.
Yeah. And I want these little baby birds to hatch.
Sure.
Well, I said, okay, here's what I'm gonna do. Here was my deal with the birds.
Okay.
Is because we have four hooks, four hanging plants.
Yeah.
I went to the very end of the house, the last hook.
Okay.
And I took that flower and I put it towards the front. And I took the dead one with the eggs in it and I put it on the end.
Okay.
So I moved the nest and this potted plant about 8 feet.
Okay. But you, the plants are still dead. You just...
The plant is still dead.
Okay.
But I'm willing to absorb whatever ramifications of that is.
Yeah.
To save these birds.
I mean, because you think, you know, nobody's going to come to the house and say, I don't want to buy this house because that plant is dead.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Then I encountered when I was taking this plant away that the birds were swooping.
That's what they do.
They were swooping at me.
Oh, boy.
And I'm like, I get it. I'm sorry. I'm not a threat.
Uh-huh.
I know I look like it.
Uh-huh.
I'm not.
Yes.
I'm trying to help you.
Uh-huh.
I'm just trying. So you got to work with me.
I've been
So they're in the tree in front of my house watching me.
Okay.
I see them. They're
yeah.
changing uh-huh. their heads. Yeah. They're looking this way. They're looking yeah. there. They're eye on me like a hawk.
Uh-huh.
So then I hang the other one up on the end.
Okay.
And I'm like, there you go. There's your nest. It's right there. And I don't know if they've been back is my problem. Okay. I don't know if they've been back. I don't know if they're so confused that I took it from here and put it right here, literally 8 feet away.
Yeah.
Still in the same area.
Yeah.
But I swapped these plants, and I think they're confused.
I think they'll check and see. Like, they'll go and see that the eggs are not there, and they'll check the other plants before they take off. I would think so.
I hope so. Unfortunately, it is generally illegal to move or destroy an active bird's nest when there are eggs or hatchlings in it. Under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, the MBTA, and almost all birds are under this
treaty.
So
even if you just switch it from one area to another, that's still considered illegal?
I don't know.
I don't think it would
now
be.
I'm a little concerned. 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. Have you experienced this? Like, did the birds end up moving to where they needed to go to? Because, again, I did move it far.
Yeah.
I moved it just a couple of feet down.
Down, yeah.
It is illegal to touch or move or destroy a nest if it has eggs or baby birds in it. I don't know if I violated the MBTA or not.
Well, you know, my wife plants, you know, she's planted flowers. We have flower pots by the garage, and we have flower pots on the back porch and the front porch, and the squirrels will come and dig in there
mm-hmm.
and put their, they won't have a nest there, but they'll put their food in there.
Oh, sure.
Nuts and all
sure,
that
sure,
stuff.
Sure, sure.
And then, which kills my plant. And so she puts mothballs in there. She buries mothballs into the dirt and then puts the plant there, and it keeps the squirrels out because they don't like the smell, and it doesn't do anything to the plant. The plant still grows. You still water it, and everything still grows, but those
really?
Mothballs keep the squirrels out.
Does it smell like mothballs?
It has a little mothball smell, they don't like that, and so they just, it's because these guys really have nerve. Chris, I told you about my squirrels. We won't get into that part, but I've told you my squirrels are different. they're a little different.
Yeah, yeah.
They're a little different, and so they got nerve, man. They got nerve. That's all I can say.
I don't know. I my like guilt has taken over because I feel terrible. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen here. I feel like I've heard less birds since I moved the basket.
So what if you have called someone like a bird sanctuary or like a animal? I wonder if you called them and they came out and did something, would that make you feel better and, you know, feel like you're off
I think
the hook.
They probably would have said no.
They probably would have just said, just leave it there.
That's like their spot. They know exactly where it is.
Yeah.
They built it. It's there. The eggs are there. It's there. I think they probably would have said, you got to leave it. Unfortunately, that dead plant was right next to the first plant you see when you walk towards the house.
Yeah.
So I got to.
And I guess it doesn't make a difference even if it's on your property. You can.
I don't know that matters.
It's one thing if it was on some property near your house or by, you know, and you go into our mess. But if it's on your property, you still don't have the right to move
well,
it.
Well, I don't think so. And I'm going to feel very badly if they don't come back to this nest. The guilt is heavy here.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The 11th annual Cyber Physical System Security Summit is happening at Oakland University here in just a couple of weeks. It's a very important summit to talk about national security in a whole lot of different ways. We're going to talk about that and a whole lot more coming up. It's JR Morning. So the Wall Street Journal reported back in April that senior Pentagon officials have approached companies like General Motors and Ford about expanding military production capacity and reactivating, you know, kind of Detroit's standing as the arsenal of democracy. And this all comes as the National Defense Industrial Association, the Michigan chapter, will hold their 11th annual Cyber Physical System Security Summit, the CPS3, on June 16th and 17th at Oakland University. And yes, we need to build strong military systems.
Yes.
But we also, that cannot come at the expense of cybersecurity. And here to talk about the event is Jennifer Tisdale, the co-chair of CPS3 and board member of the NDIA Michigan. Jennifer, good morning. It's great to have you.
Hi, good morning, Chris. Happy birthday, Lloyd.
Thank you.
You know, it feels like it feels like as more momentum is picked up around, you know, military installations like Selfridge, that Michigan, Detroit specifically, is becoming a hub for and a bigger focus of the federal government and their view on national defense and defense priorities. And the fact that Michigan is at the heart of that and now reaching out to companies like General Motors or Ford, I think it reinforces that belief as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's something we need to talk more about here in the state of Michigan. We have a strong automotive industry, but less recognized, I believe, is how the auto industry supports our military and our defense operations. And so we have a plethora of, you know, automotive engineers, software developers. We talk about, and I believe you were talking earlier about autonomous vehicles. A lot of that comes down to software, and where there's software, there are cybersecurity opportunities for vulnerability. And that's really what we're trying to draw attention to is, yes, we want to be the heart of the defense industrial base. We want to build a bridge with automotive and aerospace as well. But we also need to talk about cybersecurity implications and how to increase resilience.
And Jennifer, talk about what's the core message of this upcoming Cyber Physical System Security Summit that's going to be on June 16th and 17th. What's the core message?
Well, the core message, we need to stay topical, right? And with technology, we have to be in a forever state of learning, new tools, tactics, new opportunities for threat mitigation when it comes to cybersecurity and software, but also it's about building a community, a think tank, if you will, where we come together for education, future workforce readiness concerns, to teach and educate and provide awareness on where the technology is strong and also where it may be weak. And so what we try to do through NDIA Michigan, specifically with the CPS3 event, is we build an opportunity to bring hackers and developers together. I love that we bring together the makers and the breakers, because you can't make something stronger, a system, an autonomous vehicle, a drone, robots, without understanding where it is also weak. And so we bring that community together, and we really focus on topical issues this year, heavily influenced by artificial intelligence. It's changing the game across the board. And so we're, you know, primarily bringing everyone together for education and awareness and to talk about tools and tactics so that we can be ready as a nation.
So the hackers get a free pass for a couple of days, just a couple of days?
They do.
Yeah,
yeah, they do. We bring them up on stage. They're our friends.
Good. Okay.
Good. You know, we've heard from some wonderful military minds that this next iteration of even warfare is going to be vastly different. It is going to be fought on the cyber front. Do you notice a major shift? Obviously, you need to be ready on the physical side of things, but when things go towards the cyber side, does that change the way that the Pentagon or groups like the National Defense Industrial Association looks at how to be prepared to either defend or go on the offensive for the best interests of our country?
Yeah, absolutely. It's already changing the game, and often in ways that you wouldn't typically consider. In fact, we heard a story. I heard you mention Operation Epic Fury, right? Mm-hmm. So there was the incident with the Michigan company, Stryker, West Michigan, that had allegedly been hacked by an Iranian group. We're seeing an uptick in these activities, right? So the nature of war is changing. The barriers, the cost barriers, It's so much easier now. You don't need a lot of resources. You just need a laptop and a keyboard and access to the internet to launch cyber attacks into the ethers. And we're seeing that oftentimes they're doing that research and playing with networks much earlier, maybe even residing in networks until there's an opportune moment for them to wreak havoc, if you will. And we're also looking at cyber warfare as it impacts physical elements, right? So grid security, are the utilities within our hometowns vulnerable to such attacks? And unfortunately, the answer is yes. And so we're not just looking at autonomous vehicles, we're looking at the connected infrastructure for smart cities and intelligent transportation systems that these vehicle and devices operate within. And so the whole nature of warfare is changing, and it's becoming more a conversation, honestly, about homeland defense. How will we respond? How will we react if critical infrastructure in our state is negatively impacted? And so it's about readying everybody, readying the troops and readying the civilian workforce that needs to know how to respond.
And I'm wondering, Jennifer, how do you write a national playbook or strategy for a fight that literally has no established rules?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, Lloyd. Thank you for asking that, because you have to always be in the state of mind of worst case scenario. And oftentimes, because the game is changing so quickly, you don't know what that game will look like, but you have to be keeping track of where the, I'm going to say, air quote, hacker mindset is at. And that's why it's so important at the Cyber Physical Systems Security Summit to bring that hacker point of view into the conversation. Where is the adversarial perspective? What is the motivation? Oftentimes, it's money. Sometimes it's a nation state, and it might be considered an act of war or a questionable act of war. And so being able to think like an attacker helps you be a better defender.
Really interesting stuff. Jennifer Tisdale, the co-chair of the 11th Annual Cyber Physical System Security Summit. It's happening at Oakland University June 16th and 17th. Thank you for the time and for drawing attention to this. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you got it.
Big deal.
Interesting stuff. It's a huge deal. Yeah, it's a huge deal. Your daughter is in the military.
In the military,
so
yes.
She has a front row seat to a lot of this.
A lot of it, yes. I just got finished speaking with her. She just called me and wished her dad.
Oh, very nice. So, that was very
thank
nice.
Thank you, daughter.
thank you, daughter. Iranian state television has broadcasted the reading of a new statement reportedly written by Mujtaba Khamenei, who has not been seen in public since he was appointed the supreme leader in March. The statement in part read, the Iranian nation with its new mission alongside the resistance front has become a source of pride for free nations. The hegemonic system which established Israel nearly 80 years ago does not bear a strong, independent and privileged Iran on the eastern borders of the void and fake greater Israel. The statement went on to say that the United States and Israel has sustained heavy blows in the conflict with Iran.
Okay. Are we going to make a deal? That's what I want to know. Are you going to negotiate in good faith, and are we going to make a deal?
But, I mean, in terms of what that statement could read, it, you know, it's not quite as boisterous as you might expect.
No.
Defending the oppressed is not only an Islamic duty, but a human and Iranian one as well. The ruling established in Washington has a problem with this nation's identity, independence, and refusal to surrender. Again, strong, but, you know, it doesn't sound
wild like we've heard.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. It's just interesting. Meanwhile, coming up on the other side, some communities in Metro Detroit considering suing Priority Waste. What's happening there? We'll talk about it. It's JR Morning. Well, some communities in the metro area
are... Hey, Chris, excuse me. Before you get started here,
yes,
we have a guest on the line who has a special message briefly ahead of Mr. Bryan.
Okay. Let's go to our special guest on the line.
Mr. Tisdale, go ahead.
Good. Lloyd, State Representative Mark Tisdale, just wanted to wish you a happy birthday.
Thank you, Representative. I really appreciate it. Thanks for calling in.
I had nothing else to do on my drive into Lansing.
Well, first of all, thank you for listening. And second of all, thanks for the birthday shout-out. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. And The JR morning team carries me into Lansing every day.
We appreciate that. Yeah, thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. It's good to hear from you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Right.
Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
How about that?
That's nice, man. That's
How
great.
About that?
Yeah. Enjoy it.
I guess we should ask him about Priority Waste while we had him on the line as well. but there are a number of communities that are considering filing a lawsuit against Priority Waste because of some shoddy service. And so you've got officials in these cities that are considering switching or have switched. There's going to be a new CEO of Priority Waste, or actually in place over the last 3 days, June 1st. Aaron Johnson stepped into that role. But it's the lack of service. It's unreliable in a lot of cases.
Listen, when you have trash piling up, people are going to start having a problem with that. They don't want that. You know, out of all the things you could have, you don't want trash piling up in front of your house.
No doubt about it. Max Bryan is on the Oakland County beat for the Detroit News and joins us this morning. Max, it's good to have you. What are leaders in these communities saying as a reason for potentially taking legal action?
Well, I mean, it's just pretty much what you said. It's trash piling up in front of people's houses.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one thing that is kind of interesting is I did follow some of the communities in the second half of 2025 after, you know, whenever Priority Waste was trying to, you know, they were kind of recognizing, okay, we have all these problems and we're trying to get ahead of it. And so one of the things they did was try to remediate some of the frustrations that people had with the call center. And what they did was they staggered the bill payment over, you know, bill payment was for trash pickup was just at one point during the year. And so you got this giant backup of, you know, of calls. And so they tried to stagger that over months for different communities. And, you know, but apparently it wasn't enough because in February, the board fired Todd Stamper, the founder and CEO of Priority Waste.
Mm.
I know several officials, Max, suggested that Priority may have expanded maybe too quickly after acquiring GFL's municipal operations. Is there a growing belief that the company kind of took on more communities than they could effectively serve?
Well, I think you probably just have to look at the evidence. They're now owned by a new management firm, TPG, and they've had to inject $190 million into Priority Waste to upgrade its truck fleet and settle outstanding claims and improve efficiency. So that's almost one-fifth of $1 billion. That's not an insignificant amount of money. And so just the fact that they've had to do that, I think probably – I don't want to draw any conclusions here, but that definitely speaks to kind of where the company is at. But like you said, 2 years ago, they took on all of GFL's contracts and became the largest trash hauler in Metro Detroit. And that was 140 contracts that they took on.
Wow. Mm.
Are these lawsuits that are being thought about, are they like class action lawsuits that people would receive damages from? Are they lawsuits to try to break contracts? I mean, St. Clair Shores was just able to get with Express Waste after their contract with Priority Waste expires on July 1st, so that's coming for those in St. Clair Shores. But what type of legal action are we looking at here?
Well, that's actually not something I'm too terribly familiar with. Okay. However, I can tell you that some communities like Clinton Township, for instance, fined Priority for poor service. Their board of trustees actually approved, you know, a fine that the company had to pay out to the township, and basically saying, you know, this is not up to the standard that our residents expect or that we expect, considering that we're contracting with you.
And I'm wondering too, you know, the effects of trash piling up Max in front of people's homes, and a lot of times, you know, trash, it draws rodents, and now you may have a rodent problem. Is all that incorporated, and what priority have to deal with that as well once this is all worked out?
I mean, I've attended township board of trustees meetings, city council meetings, where priority waste was on the agenda, and I heard those irate residents saying it's gone, you know, 3 and 4 days without my trash getting picked up. And those definitely are concerns for sure.
Yeah.
Interesting. Max Bryan, thank you for your time on this story. We'll continue to watch it. You will too. We'll talk soon.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah.
Nate Bargatze, the comedian, does a great bit. He's like, it's the worst to miss trash day.
Dude.
Because then you got people coming over. You're like, put the trash in your pockets. Take it home with you. Take it somewhere else. And we ain't got no room here.
Listen, you find dumpsters at supermarkets and stores getting really full because people say, it's got to go somewhere.
Yeah, but again, like, this is the frustration for people. It's like, you plan it out. You have all of your stuff out to the curb where it needs to go.
Yes.
And then you're just a no-show.
Yeah.
And then it just sits there and sits there and sits because you don't know if you're going to bring it back in if they come the next day.
Exactly.
So you got to let it just sit
there.
You
got to let it sit there.
Absolutely. And it's a huge problem. A huge problem. Coming up on the other side, we'll get you caught up on the latest headlines that you need to know about. Also, we'll talk more about the Scott Pelley firing at CBS or the shakeup there at 60 Minutes. Does this affect broadcast journalism, or was this an isolated case of somebody, you know,
just
losing their cool at their employer?
Yeah.
It's all coming up on JR Morning. All right, 8 o'clock hour. Good to have you. Celebrating Lloyd today and his 60th birthday.
6-0, baby. 6-0.
How about that? It's your birthday. It really is. It's your birthday. It's amazing. You don't look a day over 59. I don't know how you do it.
I am 45 with 15 years experience.
How about that?
That's pretty good.
Acknowledge me!
I like the way you frame that.
That's how I feel.
That's very good.
Yeah.
Well, you know, obviously the talks between the United States and Iran continue, and the hostilities, though, have not necessarily abetted in southern Lebanon, because Israel and Hezbollah continue to launch attacks through the night into this morning, despite an agreement on the implementation of the ceasefire that was announced yesterday. The deal is contingent on a complete cessation of Hezbollah fire and the evacuation of its forces from the south sector, but both Israel and Hezbollah continued their military strikes, and that's problematic. Again,
we're still negotiating, though, right? Supposedly,
I mean, there's this. You know, they agreed to the implementation of the ceasefire, but it hasn't quite taken effect yet.
And
that was at the heart of the contentious conversation that Donald Trump had with Benjamin Netanyahu.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these things are ongoing, and then you've got the talks between the United States and Iran as well, and that was obviously a major focus over the last couple of days for Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who testified to Congress, and his basic message was, you know, the United States is working towards a diplomatic peace here.
Yeah.
And obviously all the economic ramifications are still in place, the blockade and all of those things. But the memorandum of understanding has at least been put out there, and all of those considerations are still ongoing. Iran's position has been, we're not going to negotiate on nuclear until we stop this war. You open up the straits, we can go forward. But to me, that feels like a head fake. I'm not entirely sure that Iran is willing to negotiate in any good faith yet.
No.
But the president says that they've made progress, whatever that means. We've heard that before.
We have. And then the House yesterday voted to kind of curtail the president's war powers, but it's probably not going anywhere.
No, it was a 215 to a 208 vote. There were 1, 2, 3, 4 Republicans were hopped over to the Democrat side. The one Democrat in the House that was voting against his party joined the caucus again,
and
so they had those 5 votes. Tom Barrett was one of the ones for Michigan that voted in favor of that on the Republican side. So, again, they voted to basically prevent the president from using military force without congressional approval in Iran, but they say Operation Epic Fury is over, the military strikes, the military actions that we had seen through many, many weeks is over. And now they're in the diplomatic phase. The blockade is still in place.
It's kind of economic fury still, right?
Correct, yes. So that all is still there. Again, whether this gets through the Senate or not, the president can veto it. They don't have the votes to override the veto. So yeah. It is symbolic for the most part.
An effort to overhaul how Michigan's public universities are selected. That's failed in the State House, even after Governor Gretchen Whitmer voiced her support for changing the system. Now, the proposal needed a two-thirds majority to advance to the August ballot, but it fell short in the Republican-led House. It received 52 votes in favor, 54 against. House Speaker Matt Hall defended the measure ahead of the vote, saying the state needed to restore balance and address ongoing instability at the universities. And opponents raised concerns about concentrating too much power in appointed positions and changing a system that currently allows voters to elect board members statewide. With the measure now defeated, lawmakers could revisit the issue for a possible November ballot, but time is running out, and it's running short before the deadline. So they got to get on it if they want to try to change that.
Yeah. The Department of Homeland Security and Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen saying this week that CBP, Customs and Border Protection, are ready to go to facilitate trade and travel across the newly built Gordie Howe International Bridge once negotiations between Canada and the United States are resolved. He says that we have the personnel dedicated, ready to move. We're prepared, we're staffed, we're ready to go. There's still negotiations between Canada and the United States. That's not within DHS. That has to be resolved. But we're as far as we can go without the sign-off from the bridge and the final agreement between the two parties. Gary Peters also responded. We're waiting on that to take place.
Okay.
in the conversation and testimony from Mark Wayne Mullen to those senators. So the Windsor Detroit Bridge Authority said that progress is well towards a spring opening. So we're still on track for a spring opening. But Mark Wayne Mullen says there still needs to be some things talked about in order to move that forward.
Detroit's Coleman A. Young Municipal Airport celebrating a major milestone with the opening of its first new hangar facility in nearly 60 years. Mayor Mary Sheffield helped cut the ribbon yesterday on a 20,000-square-foot hangar and 5,000-square-foot operations terminal built by AV Flight, a company that has operated at the airport since 2011 and says it invested millions into the new facility. City leaders say the upgrade strengthens aviation infrastructure on Detroit's east side and supports growing activity at the airport, which now handles roughly 4,500 takeoffs and landings a year, far more than a decade ago, though still below its peak in the 1990s. Airport officials say the site remains a key hub for private and corporate aviation, especially during major events like the Detroit Grand Prix. The airport is also looking toward future development, including potential commercial use of former runway land, and its officials continue working with the FAA on a long-planned new control tower project. I remember when there was passenger service at City Airport. Man, that was convenient, man. You could fly right into the city, get on the freeway, and get home and not have to worry about flying, you know, into Metro and taking that drive to wherever you live. You were closer, especially if you lived in a city.
Right.
You know, you could just fly right in. But then they tried to extend the runway so we could get more airlines in, and then we ran into a problem with Warren because it would have extended into a cemetery. Mm-hmm. And Warren didn't want to move that or do anything with that, so it kind of died. So we've got a lot of private planes and corporate planes to come in and out of there, so it's still great for business here in the city.
Yeah, certainly. Tigers win yesterday. They complete the sweep of the Tampa Bay Rays 7-2. They scored three in the fourth, and that was all it took. They had another run added in the ninth inning. Troy Melton gets the win. Eight innings pitched, four hits, two earned runs, five strikes, two walks. Gleyber Torres, this team looks different with Torres in the lineup.
Yeah.
He had three hits, three runs. Kevin McGonigal with a pair of hits. Dylan Dingler with a pair of hits. Riley Green with a pair of hits as well. So the bats are coming alive here a little bit for the Tigers.
I mean, what happened? I mean, was it the drops, Jason, that got those bats going?
That's called a winning streak.
Yep, it must
have been. Dylan Dingler, that's going to be your all-star representative, I believe. He's having a great season.
Yeah, I agree. He's been probably the most consistent player on this roster.
Absolutely.
Kevin McGonigal has been a wonderful addition.
He has.
Right? He's played really, really well. But I agree. Dylan Dingler has been the most consistent player on this team, and he will represent. At this point, of the players who played yesterday, Riley Green, the only player batting over 300. He's batting 311 for his average. And Kevin McGonigal right on the doorstep there, too. But, yeah, got to get the bats going a little bit.
We're not the worst place team. We're not the last place team anymore,
yeah,
right?
We're second to last.
Okay.
In the
small steps.
That's right.
But Baby steps.
You can't get to first if you don't start somewhere.
Crawl before you walk.
That's exactly right.
That's called a winning streak.
There you go.
Coming up on the other side, we're going to talk about the Scott Pelley firing. What does this mean for journalism? Is there an impact here? We'll talk about it next. It's JR Morning. That's Tim McGraw, and it's WJR's Tim McGraw VIP Experience, your chance to rock when country music legend Tim McGraw brings his Pawn Show guitar tour to Pine Knob Music Theater August 28th, and you could win a pair of premium pavilion tickets, transportation courtesy of Metro Cars, and $100 to Buddy's Pizza. To enter, all you got to do is download the free WJR mobile app, find the secret keyword, and then text it to 800-859-0957. Download the free WJR mobile app, find the secret keyword, and then text it to 800-859-0WJR. More information is available at WJR.com. So we've been watching the fallout of the Scott Pelley firing from 60 Minutes at CBS. And the question that many people have been asking, well, what role did Donald Trump have in this, right? We saw that after the Stephen Colbert exit from The Late Show.
Right.
And if there was pressure from up above, I don't think that's the case. I think that there is a shift happening at CBS News. Barry Weiss comes in,
but CBS
changes
did pay
things.
Some money though. Didn't they pay some money out for something? Did they pay the
Donald
Trump for something?
Yes.
Too?
So it was a 60 minute. Of course, yeah. The 60 minutes
too.
Interview with Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
But does this change the way that journalism is looked at or should be received? By you. Fred Volte is a professor of journalism in the Department of Communications at Wayne State University and joins us to talk about it. Professor, good morning. It's good to have you.
Good morning. Good to talk to you guys.
Let's talk about it because there was a contentious meeting between the crew at 60 Minutes and the new executive producer that was brought on. And Scott Pelley seemed to take umbrage with the fact that he didn't believe this person was qualified for the job. And there was a very public at least according to reports, kind of lashing out by Scott Pelley, and that seems to be the catalyst for his firing. What did you make of those reports, and what's your analysis of it?
Well, remember, he's not the beginning of the story here, so that meeting was in reaction to a couple of other people getting pushed out the door at 60 Minutes already. So Barry Weiss called a meeting with her new executive producer, and things kind of went south from there. So it seems like Scott Pelley's been, 30 years with the network now, or close to that, kind of took umbrage to some of this and wanted some fairly direct answers and didn't think that he and his product were being treated fairly or honestly. Management then, as management will sometimes do when you call them out, decided that they were going to bring an end to things. And that's, again, that's not the beginning of the story and it's not the end. What I'm seeing just this morning is that the few remaining correspondents at 60 Minutes got together last night for an hour to talk about their future. So we're kind of, I think they're in a hiatus right now for the summer, so they've got some time to try to patch things up and put it back together. And depending on who they can have and which of the technical people are around that can still put a show on the air, we'll kind of know some more when we get to fall and when the season opens up again.
Friend, management argues that Pelley essentially undermined leadership and disrupted the workforce. Where is the line between standing up for journalistic principles and insubordination?
Well, that's one where we pretty much have to call it every day, don't we? Y'all are doing journalism, and that's a decision people have to make on the spur of the moment. There may not be a firm line between there. And I think we'd all like to think that when something is disrupted to the point, so one of the people who was pushed out was the woman responsible for the Seacott report, you remember back in December? Right, when Barry Weiss, with a couple of hours' notice, held up a report that was already ready that was widely thought to be the sort of thing that would anger Donald Trump. So she's out the door. Other staffers, other producers were out the door. And it's really hard to say that, a response to that is kind of going over the top if you're saying, the line that set things off was, well, I think you brought her in to murder 60 Minutes. It's really hard to say when that goes too far over the top.
Do you anticipate, and just in your crystal ball, you talked a little bit about, the hiatus now and going into the fall. What does 60 Minutes look like on the other side of this?
that's going to depend on who's left and what they can put together. It might look pretty much like it does. And if you look at 60 Minutes' audience, that's actually held pretty stable mm-hmm. over the past year or so. CBS News in general got a little bit of an initial bump when Tony took over the anchor spot, mm-hmm. kind of fallen back to where it was. You know, it's very comfortable third place among the broadcast networks after that. You know, people tune into news for, you know, theory we call uses and gratifications. People use the media for different reasons. And if what people are used to is on Sunday night, I get three good magazine-style reports, there may not be too much impact. If people look at this and say, this is too much interference, I'm not sure I can believe what I will see on here anymore, that could cause an impact, or it could settle somewhere. And the crystal ball is really cloudy on that.
Many Americans already distrust the media. Does a public fight like this deepen that skepticism, or could it actually increase trust because people are seeing the internal tensions play out openly?
It's unusual to see this much tension play out openly. It has happened before. It's happened in the mainstream media. It's happened in the partisan media. We don't see it all the time, but it does crop up. There's a chance that some people will look at this and be heartened. There's also a chance, you know, there are some people who, you know, I don't think it's going to make more people distrust CBS. I think the people who already do are going to would be very hard to persuade.
Uh-huh.
People who are in the middle, again, you have to remember, most people don't pay attention to what goes on in the glass offices. And when we hear about that, so you remember the Washington Post, their big non-endorsement in 2024?
Yep.
Right. They took a big hit from that, and I think part of that would be because people could see the difference. You could pick up your Washington Post, and there would not be a presidential endorsement where they were expecting it. Mm. They took a huge subscriber hit around that time. Will people actually see a difference in CBS when they turn it on? I think it's kind of like the news. We make a lot of noise about the changes. We make a lot of noise about somebody coming in because we're media watchers. We do that kind of thing. What do people see on the ground? New York Times didn't take a hit when they basically got rid of their sports section and their copy desk. Were people missing something that they couldn't get anymore, or could they look at the product and say, "Nah, it's pretty much here. I'm good for that. Now we're going to turn over to the Macy's ads and the world coverage."
Well, and the other part too is people like consistency.
Yeah.
And when you pull that rug out from under them, there's already going to be a built-in anger.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll see if that's reflected by the ratings and how many people are watching 60 Minutes. Professor Fred Volti, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Interesting insight. We'll talk again soon.
Enjoyed it. Look forward to it.
Yeah, you got it. Interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib has pushed to pass legislation that would put a halt the brakes on the Lebanon War Powers resolution, this back and forth mm-hmm. with Lebanon. And it has caused a real division, not only amongst Republicans but Democrats as well. And you have those that are on the more moderate side of things saying that, you know, we need to watch this closely. It's basically ripping open old wounds. Mm-hmm. And Rashida Tlaib is making a lot of people angry. Not the first time.
No, I was about to say, I'm surprised.
Done really? That in Congress.
Yeah.
Coming up on the other side, Donald Trump says gas prices are coming down quickly. Are they? We'll talk about it.